Wego, you have November 7th through the 30th.
How could she do this to me?
Arwego grouses to himself. It's lousy beach weather. He starts turning his upper body away toward the door, but stops midway, remembering, that's Thanksgiving. Oh well, at least we can now plan a family trip. He pivots halfway back toward his boss.
Don, yours is March 1st through the 15th.
Dang.
Don doesn't like that one bit.
What a witch she is.
He leans back, folds his arms, and turns his shoulders more toward the door. Even if these employees had bags over their heads, you wouldn't need to be psychic to know how each of them felt about their boss at that moment. Kelsey's warmth, Arwego's disappointment, Don's anger. All were obvious because the way their upper bodies were facing was a dead giveaway. Your eyes, arms, hands, legs, and every other part of your body reveal your emotions to the discerning eye. But the direction in which your upper body turns shouts it. No clairvoyance necessary. Sidney Patterson is probably the most beloved supervisor at one company where I consult. When conducting meetings, she never sits at the head of the long rectangular conference table. Instead, she positions herself between two employees on one of the long sides, and whenever one of her reports speaks, she pivots her head and chest in that individual's direction. She nods as she listens to each, making it clear she understands and occasionally interjects. That's an interesting point. I see what you're saying. Or, we'll definitely have to think about that. The only times she looks away are to briefly scribble a note on her pad about what the employee is saying, which makes each feel valued. I also notice that whenever she speaks to one of her employees in the hall, her body turns 100% toward that individual. If talking with two of them, the top of her body pivots gently from one to the other. Every single direct report feels heard and cared for, and it certainly pays off for Sydney. Her team members are loyal, and they give their supervisor the best they have every time. One time while chatting with Sydney, I complimented her on her listening skills. She said, "Leal, I owe it all to my dad, who was a theatrical lighting designer." "Your dad?" I asked, surprised. She continued, "I must have been a typical indifferent teenager because Dad was forever telling me I had to listen better. One time he put his foot down and threatened I'd be grounded unless I played a game he suggested to me. I didn't want that, so I grudgingly agreed. He told me to imagine I had a big flashlight shining out of my chest. Whenever you're talking to someone, turn that flashlight toward the person you're speaking with." "Okay," I muttered. It felt strange at first. But soon it became a natural habit, and I didn't even have to think about it. I started shining my chest flashlight on everybody I talked to, and have done so ever since. I see a big difference in people's reactions to me, and I know I'm not imagining it. So don't thank me, Leal. Thank my dad. Aha, I thought. That's why Sydney appears to be an excellent listener. For the rest of the time I worked with her, I was conscious of her little trick and noticed how beautifully it worked. It does for me now, too, and it's become second nature. Little trick number 14. The torso flashlight. Whenever you're standing talking with someone, do more than turn your head toward the person. Swivel your entire torso like you have a bright flashlight shining out from your chest. Even at a conference table, turn your torso slightly toward the speaker. Everyone you aim your beam toward feels heard, understood, and appreciated, which is crucial to caring communication. Oh, I should mention a slight gender difference here. If you're a man talking one-on-one with another male, the rules change a bit. If you stand directly face-to-face with each other, it can come across as too personal, perhaps even aggressive. So, gentlemen, when talking to another man, turn ever so slightly to the side. You can also imagine a spotlight coming out of your chest, but make it a wide-angle floodlight that gives you more flexibility and permits you to turn to a slightly less than 45-degree angle. If you're at a desk or conference table, however,
You can turn more directly toward another man because the furniture between you serves as your safety zone. Because men seldom stand directly face to face when talking, unless they're angry, they don't pick up on many of the communication subtleties that females do. So women, when something breaks down in the communication chain at work, give the guys a break. They're working with a handicap. Chapter 14. Don't give hit-and-run praise. If a colleague grants you a favor at work or a direct report does a great job on an assignment, of course you thank them. It's only expected, and you'd be rude not to. But what's the real point of saying thank you? It's to express your gratitude and make the recipient feel good about what he's done, right? But the usual thanks, or even good job, is as common as fleas on a dog. So when it comes out of your mouth, it's like elevator music. People hardly hear it. I'd like to share a quick and easy technique that accomplishes the true purpose of a thank you. And in the process, it makes the recipient want to do more for you. When your supervisor, passing you in the hall, says, "Thanks for finding that document this morning," sure, you're pleased. You're happy about her praise, and the pleasure lasts, at least until you get to the end of the hall. But picture this instead. She comes out of her office, makes a trip over to your desk, stops, smiles, looks you straight in the eyes, uses your name, and says, "I am so impressed you were able to find that missing document this morning. Obviously, someone saved it in the wrong folder. But you stayed late yesterday and went through the whole computer until you found the original. You just didn't give up, and I really appreciate it. Thanks so much." Wow, now you feel fantastic. Your inner smile lingers all day, and while driving home, you're still feeling good about it. At dinner, you might even tell your family what she said. Suddenly, you like your supervisor a whole lot more. And naturally, the next time she has a problem, you'll definitely go the extra mile for her. It's a win-win situation for both of you, all because she gave you a few more sentences of gratitude. Now, let's say a colleague you were never really crazy about, Kaylee, asks you to proofread a report she wrote. "Geez, she never did anything for me," you grouse. "Why should I help her out? Besides, I've got enough work of my own. I don't have time for this." But being the accommodating person that you are, you say, "Sure, Kaylee, leave it right here." At the end of the afternoon, you take it to her desk with the markings you made. She glances at it, and of course you expect a thank you. But instead, she looks up at you with a grateful smile and says, "Oh my gosh, that's wonderful. You did a lot of work on it. I felt so guilty asking you, but I was at my wit's end. I knew I could turn to you, and I'm so appreciative. Your writing is so much more professional than mine, and..." Now you're thinking, "Hey, this woman's not so bad after all." In fact, suddenly you have warm feelings toward Kaylee, and the seeds of a professional friendship are planted, just because she spent a few extra seconds expressing her gratitude. Whenever a colleague or report does something well or grants you a favor, keep your praise going. Stretch it out a bit. Give more details. Tell the person how it affected you and why you're grateful. One last example. Suppose you traded a day off with a coworker at your request. When it comes time to say thanks, amplify your words of gratitude by giving her specifics on what the favor did for you. Something like, "Your trading with me was super because I was way behind in my holiday shopping. I don't know what I would have done without that extra day. My son would have been devastated without his train set, and he should thank you too. I really appreciate it. I hope I can do something nice for you sometime." Now that gives your compliment some oomph. Little trick number 15. Prolong your praise. Stretch out your compliment. A simple sentence isn't enough when a coworker or a report does something you're grateful for. Go for 3 sentences minimum. The melody of your protracted praise is sweet music to their ears. Like making love, the longer it lasts, the better it is. Special note to supervisors. Please don't let this one slip through the cracks. When praising someone, don't just keep walking. Stop, pause, look directly in your employee's eyes, and only then deliver your kudos. Prolonged praise is extremely potent when coming from you. It wins their respect, loyalty, and their desire to please you. How to make your kudos extra special. No matter what industry you're in or what position you hold, from cleaning person in a grimy factory to vice president of a multinational conglomerate, every employee has a boss, and all workers want to impress theirs. Competition for the boss's favor is universal, so here's a quick tip to show you're a caring, sharing individual, which unfortunately is becoming an endangered species in certain cutthroat companies. This little trick makes your praise extra special and enhances your on-the-job relationships. Little trick number 16. Make your compliment count. Give your praise extra punch by choosing a moment when you and the coworker are casually chatting with your boss. Then find a smooth way to tell your superior about the fantastic job your coworker did. Your well-timed kudos will thrill your colleague and make you look good in your boss's eyes, too. Here's an email tip that, incidentally, also makes you look good. When writing your boss on a certain matter, if appropriate, praise a colleague's contribution. Chapter 15. Good eye contact is not enough. One of the simplest and most obvious ways to demonstrate you are a caring individual is to give everyone you work with a gift. Not a physical one, not something you pay money for, but a precious offering to make each colleague feel special. And it's free. The gift is locking eyes with everyone you're talking to. We often withhold eye contact from people who bore us or rub us the wrong way. Lack of eye contact can signal antipathy, aversion, animosity, or fear. People often shield their eyes or look away from terrifying scenes in a movie, but we instinctively look into the eyes of those we respect, admire, and appreciate. I'm sure you've seen proud parents looking lovingly at their infants for long periods of time, and lovers gazing into each other's eyes seemingly forever. Warm eye contact is a sign of approval and appreciation, respect and reverence. When your eyes lock with a coworker's, intense unconscious forces take over. A study called An Eye Movement Phenomenon Relating to Attention, Thought, and Anxiety, published in Perceptual and Motor Skills, proved that during extended contact, an adrenaline-like substance courses through people's veins and increases their heartbeat. Concentrated eye contact is a near-magical state of two brains simultaneously scanning each other, processing what they're hearing, and deciding how they feel about each other and what's being said. No other communication method matches it. Not phoning, not video conferencing, and definitely nothing digital. Eye contact has even more implications on the job because many more factors come into it. Are you in competition with the person? Has he always been straight with you? Has she ever been petty? And who wants what from whom? Additionally, whatever happens during this particular encounter shapes the timbre of the next. When you tap this powerful tool, you can even guide your coworkers to a certain extent. Leonard Bernstein was known to conduct an entire orchestra with just his eyes and eyebrows. You may have had a boss or two who controlled meetings that way. When he looked your way, you knew it was your turn to speak. When she rolled her eyes, you closed your mouth. If he nodded approvingly, you kept talking. When she squinted, you felt obligated to explain yourself. It's an unfortunate fact of life that sometimes you have to camouflage your real feelings at work. You must calibrate what is strategic to reveal and what is not, then train your eyes to express precisely the message you wish to transmit. Don't forget that at work you're playing by different rules. No matter how much you disagree or are bored by what someone is saying, you must avoid looking disinterested or disdainful. Successfully concealing that shows you have good leadership qualities and keeps workers connected to you. When you master the art of superior eye contact, you'll be handsomely rewarded in the currency of everyone's support and respect. In the cutting-edge field called neurorobotics, which combines neuroscience and artificial intelligence, roboticists don't overlook the emotional significance of eye contact. They invest millions trying to make their humanoids have just the right amount with you. They haven't yet succeeded, and just think, you can do it for free. Let your imagination help you with the following technique to show that you're interested in what your boss and colleagues have to say, enjoy listening to them, and are anxious to hear more. It involves the speed with which you break eye contact and return to it. Little trick number 17. Lock eyes. Whenever talking with coworkers, envision a rubber band stretching between your eyeballs and theirs. When you must occasionally look away, tug your eyes away slowly, reluctantly, as if you're having difficulty stretching the rubber band. Don't forget to look thoughtful and attentive during those occasional moments. Then quickly click your eyes back to lock position with theirs as though you're eagerly awaiting their next words. Not only does this powerful little trick gain allies at work, it wins over enemies. And there's yet another big benefit. When you keep your eyes on theirs, even during the silences, you come across as being an insightful abstract thinker who integrates incoming data more easily than concrete thinkers. Individuals more focused on ideas rather than their own subjective views or feelings about the relationship aren't as disturbed by intense eye contact because their minds are busy absorbing the concepts. When talking with several colleagues, do the following during a meeting or when conversing with a small group to give you the look of a leader interested in all sides of the situation being discussed. Little trick number 18. Watch the listeners. Occasionally, take your eyes off the person who is speaking and watch one or more of the other listeners. This gives the impression you have a thorough understanding of the situation and are searching for more subtleties to round out your knowledge. It also makes you look like an evaluator judging other employees' comprehension and reactions. A note of caution. Don't overdo it or it could look creepy. An additional benefit is that it makes the person you're watching feel that you care about how it affects her, too. Seeing eye to eye in today's global economy. I would be remiss if I didn't mention one last point. No doubt you're aware of the cultural differences in the meaning of eye contact. In certain Asian countries, direct eye contact does not represent honesty, confidence, interest, and forthrightness as it does in the West. There, strong eye contact can be viewed as rude or disrespectful. I knew this consciously, but once when giving a seminar in Singapore, it staggered me. Apparently, just because I was the presenter, my students had dubbed me a figure of authority. Therefore, in one-on-one conversations, they hesitated to look into my eyes. If I hadn't known about this cultural difference, I would have thought they disliked me or were totally disinterested in my words. Please understand that if some of your Asian coworkers give you less eye contact, it doesn't mean they don't respect you. In fact, it could be just the opposite. The same is true with Native Americans, and it gets even more complicated than that. The French give much more eye contact, even to strangers on the street. And in Muslim countries, beware of making eye contact with the other sex. Bottom line, big players on the international scene scoop up every speck of information they can find on cultural diversity before meeting with people from a different culture. Never forget that one of the most powerful communication skills in your arsenal is staring right back at you every time you look into a mirror. Now let's talk about some more spoken ways to show you care. Chapter 16. How to establish rapport without sacrificing your principles. A human resources professional taught me this little trick that works wonders in everyday relationships with coworkers and makes even the tough ones more bearable. It saves you hours of having to listen to gripers, gossips, yellers, and a variety of other unsavory workplace types. I first witnessed its efficacy at a company that hired me to help pull it out of the communication quicksand it was drowning in. Savannah, the HR director, had accomplished the delicate task of being liked and respected by everyone she worked with. Her office was a revolving door of employees anxious to share their highly emotional situations. Because they thoroughly trusted her confidentiality, she invited me, with the employee's permission, of course, to sit in on some of her sessions. I heard a wide variety of grumbling, such as, "My boss looks over my shoulder every second. I think micromanager is her middle name. I am way underpaid for my position. He shovels too much work my way and keeps piling it on." And of course, they griped about their colleagues who are sloppy, rude, whiners, gossips, pranksters, nonstop talkers, human loudspeakers, and untold others. One employee even said she wanted to push a certain colleague down the elevator shaft. It was scary stuff. After sitting in on several of Savannah's sessions and seeing the peevish employees walk out much calmer, I complimented her skill, saying, "You are absolutely amazing. The company is so fortunate to have you." Then I ventured, "So what's the secret of your success dealing with all their diverse problems?" Thanking me for the compliment, she replied, "Well, there is one thing I do a lot. It's really simple. While an employee is describing a problem to me, I listen with my eyes as much as my ears and try to see how they feel about whatever they're saying. I need to determine their emotions and pick up on any undercurrents." "For example," I asked. "Well, most of them are angry at their bosses or are exasperated about a company policy or customer. Tons of them tell me about a particular colleague who is driving them berserk. No matter what they're upset about, I don't say anything at first. I just listen and watch. Then, when I figure out how they're feeling, I comment, but just on their emotion." I found her technique fascinating, and it worked like a charm. I started calling it Savannah's secret formula, and was on the lookout for it at every session she let me attend. Sure enough, after listening to various distraught employees talk it out, she would say things like, "I know how troubling that must be. That must be so aggravating. I understand why you are so upset. Yes, that is disappointing." Savannah continued putting the employee's emotions in sympathetic words. Only then would this top professional communicator start using some of the more traditional HR professionals' methods. You certainly don't need to be in HR to benefit from this technique. You'd be surprised at how it helps with your office relationships, and it's so easy to do. Little trick number 19. State their sentiments. Most people who are upset go on and on just to get you to understand their agitation. Don't overdo your sympathetic response, as I've heard some people do, and it can be irritating. But by occasionally stating their sentiment from what you observe, you're already giving them what they were after: your understanding, your sympathy. When you occasionally comment on a colleague's emotions, you create a bond and can make a quicker escape. It also frees you up from having to offer an opinion on the situation, which could open a can of worms for you. Chapter 17. Is it better to be liked or respected at work? I sometimes ask my consulting clients this question during casual conversations. Quite a few say, "Being respected is most important." Don't they realize there's a glass ceiling above the heads of those who feel that way? It's not one of gender or race. This one is molded from the hidden hostility of their colleagues. Those upward strivers are struggling to crawl up a slippery slope, because without some of the caring ways of dealing with colleagues, they have enemies salivating to see them fall. Others say being liked is more important. But that sometimes means giving in to people and sacrificing your principles. A strong leader doesn't do that. I promise you, though, there are ways to garner both respect and warmth from everyone you work with. How to be both.
When the liked or respected question comes up in my seminars, I occasionally ask the students, have you ever been disciplined by a boss you respected and liked and still do? Only a few hands go up. I then ask if anyone would be comfortable sharing his or her story. I especially admired a young woman named Shauna in one of my classes who volunteered. I was impressed because it was at an in-house seminar for employees who work at the same company, which makes it doubly tough to share personal information. Shauna was a salesperson at a promotional giveaways company and started by telling us about a boss she had last year who made life for her a living hell. Part of my job was to gather ideas about product improvement every month from the whole team and write up the suggestions for my boss. She said, I like this assignment because I'd always prided myself on being a pretty good writer. In fact, I majored in English at college and was hoping to get published someday. But I began to doubt my writing ability when my boss gave me negative feedback on my first report. He called me into his office, scowled, and shoved the last report across the desk under my nose. He'd scribbled all over it with a red marker. He'd also written disparaging comments in the margins like, too flowery, ick, bad writing, and weasel words. I was crushed and felt I no longer had writing talent. I asked him what I should do next. He growled, if I were you, I'd do the whole thing over again. Then suddenly Shauna's face broke into a big smile. He was only there for a few more months before he got fired. The class cheered because apparently everyone knew who she'd been talking about and felt the same way. I found her story interesting but was confused because my question had been about having a boss who disciplined you, whom you still had warm feelings for. And after the way he handled that, you still like and respect him? I asked. Oh, no, she laughed. That was my next supervisor, and still is. Her name is Daphne. The other participants smiled and nodded, hearing her name. Shauna continued, well, after giving her my next monthly report on the findings, Daphne called me into her office. Needless to say, I was pretty nervous due to my last experience. But the first thing she said was, Shauna, that report was beautifully written. You really have a knack for writing. I wanted to hug her, she exclaimed. Hearing my new supervisor say that was super. Then Daphne explained to me that, unfortunately, the production department usually works from flat descriptions with bullet points. She called me over to her side of the desk so we could sit side by side and look at my report together. She took the time to make sure I understood precisely what she was saying about each item, and then we shaved them down and listed them by bullet points. At the end of the meeting, Daphne told me that she hated to see my talent going to waste on writing boring text. But that's the form we must give it to them in. She shrugged. I agreed. Anyway, Daphne's great, and I'm really pleased I could get her what she wanted. I worked extra hard at it after that, and she really appreciates it and often tells me so. I smiled to myself because I knew precisely what Daphne had accomplished and how she did it. She had corrected her employee without stomping on her ego by using a technique I heard about a long time ago. I don't know whom to give credit to, but thank you whoever you are because I've used it ever since. It's called the hamburger technique. The never fail technique. The following is the best way I've yet found for giving constructive criticism or feedback, and the beauty of it is that it's not just for bosses. It works wonders when trying to cure an annoying colleague of aggravating habits. Here's how it works. Imagine a big, juicy hamburger. On the top, there's half of a nice, soft, squishy bun. Under that, there's the meat, the substance of the burger. There might even be a few frills like lettuce, tomatoes, and onions. But the reason you bought the burger was for the beef. At the bottom of the burger, there's the other half of the soft bun. For those of you who are vegetarians, you can think of it as first the good stuff, then the bad stuff, and then the good stuff again. In Shauna's case, the top bun was her supervisor complimenting her writing. Under that was the meat, how to do the report correctly.
Daphne then ended the session with another nice soft bun. Little trick number 20, the hamburger technique. Whenever you must criticize people you work with, the first step is to give praise about something specific involving what you must correct them on. Step 2, give them the meat, the behavior you want them to change. Step 3, end the session with more praise. If the individual you are trying to correct needs serious schmoozing, decorate your compliment with some other welcome words. Think of those as the ketchup, mustard, cheese, and onions. If you have more than one grievance, separate the two harsh meat parts with another soft bun. That's a big whopper. You don't have to be the boss to use this little trick. This technique also works beautifully for stamping out colleagues' annoying habits. Let me tell you how I first used it more than 20 years ago. At one company I consulted for, the only extra computer was in an empty cubicle, which I used. The woman sitting in the cubicle next to me was an incontinent hummer and would sometimes croon songs to herself as she was working. It drove me nuts, and at one point I thought, enough is enough, I have to deal with this. My crooning cubicle neighbor was really full of herself, and I knew she wouldn't respond well. As I was racking my brain on how to deal with this irritating woman, I remembered I'd once read about the hamburger technique. The next time I saw her in the lunchroom, I told her what a beautiful singing voice she had. This thrilled her, and she exuberated that she'd been taking singing lessons. We chatted about that for a while, and only then did I mention that sometimes I overheard her singing to herself. I apologized and said, "It sounds so nice that I can't ignore it, and sometimes I can't concentrate on my work." We laughed about how her songs might have the same powerful effect on her fans one day, and I asked if she'd ever posted her songs on YouTube. It worked. I never heard another song coming through the cubicle wall. This woman got the point, and it caused no hard feelings. I've used the hamburger technique ever since in hundreds of different situations. Try it the next time that something really irritates you. You'll see what I mean. Chapter 18. Email Amity. If you've used the internet, then you likely have an email address. And if you have an email address, then you've written and read email. Chapter over. You've mastered communicating by email, right? You wrote what you wanted and got your point across, right? No one was hurt by or took offense at your email. No one misunderstood your email or IM. No one read too deep into your message and found hidden meanings you never intended, right? Of course recipients screwed up your intent. They read your message, processed it, and their brain turned it into whatever they wanted it to be. From the first line to your signature, how long it took you to answer, who you CC'd and who you didn't, your words are forever stamped in stone as proof of whatever they want to accuse you of. Deleting it on your computers or other devices doesn't work because a good IT department can retrieve texts or messages that were deleted months or even years ago. You can't win. Or can you? Well, yes. Because there are ways to keep your emails from lighting a spark that can turn into a company explosion. I won't get into too many particular tips because there are excellent ones plastered all over the web, such as optimize for mobile. Avoid attachments unless expected. Use short, relevant subject lines, less than 35 characters. Don't change subject lines mid-thread. Write short paragraphs and keep your email as brief as possible. Bullet points are good. All caps is shouting. All lowercase is childish. Never assume privacy. Watch out for reply all if you didn't intend to. Be sensitive to time zones. Run spell check and proofread. Avoid weekend or after-hours business messages. Be judicious with BCC, because it can make you look sneaky. Make sure all links work. so your message doesn't get lost in the hundreds that the recipients may be faced with when they come to work, don't send until shortly after their usual arrival time. Suite sign-offs and signatures. This late in the game, however, I found some people still get screwy with their signatures, so let's address that for a moment. If you're writing outside your company, a simple, automatically generated footer with just your company information suffices. You don't even need that if you're writing to someone with whom you work continually or closely. You can precede the footer with a simple, many thanks, appreciated, or cheers. Avoid signatures with flamboyant fonts, photos, flashing company logos, or pretentious graphics that take ages to download. Too bad there isn't an unsubscribe button for some people you have to deal with. Here's a little trick, a thoroughly professional way to give your messages warmth that I haven't come across anywhere else. When writing to a customer, colleague, or boss, most employees use the recipient's name right off the bat. Something like, "Hi, Hayden." "Hello, Hayden." "Hey, Hayden." Or maybe just plain, "Hayden." But don't let this attention-getter, the person's name, lose punch by putting it in its expected place. Make it work for you by saving it for another part of your message, either to flag an important point or strengthen a bond at the end of your message. Just like people perk up when hearing their name in a crowd, they'll pay more attention when their name jumps out at them later in your message. Let's say you need Hayden's response to a question by a certain time. If you just write, "I need your answer by 2 p.m. on Friday," he might miss it. Flag the significance by slapping his name smack dab next to it. Write, "I need your answer, Hayden, by 2 p.m. And he will pay more attention to the 2 p.m. deadline. Also, using the recipient's name as the final word of your message adds a caring touch. You've probably heard that people's names are the sweetest sound in the English language to them. So instead of opening your message with it as expected, close your email with, "It was good working with you, Hayden," or "I'm looking forward to hearing from you, Hayden." Little trick number 21. Punch up your points with their name. Use the recipient's name to your advantage in your email messages. If you want a particular point to stand out in the middle of your message, flag it by putting the person's name right next to it. And you can make all your office messages sound more personal and caring by using people's names as the last word of your email. Just don't overdo it. Writing the recipient's name once or twice in your message is enough. Make your messages exciting without emojis. Almost everyone secretly enjoys smiley faces with devil horns, hearts, monkeys, surprise, and shrug emojis. How did we ever express ourselves without silly little pictures to show how we feel? Using emojis today, it's not so much a generational gap as a professionalism gap. Times are changing fast, but many still feel an emoji is proof that the writer has a weak vocabulary. So what's an emoji-addicted professional to do? Here are some tips. Don't send an emoji to people who are above you in the hierarchy unless they send one to you first. Avoid them in work communications to people at other companies, even if they're good friends. If your email is shared, you and your company can quickly lose credibility. A note on personal communication. Don't send emojis to anyone born before 1980 unless you know them well. Then there's the ultimate emoji, the GIF. It's an emoji on steroids. So much can go wrong sending those in a professional context that you should forget they even exist. What about the original emoji, the exclamation point? Now that people are drowning in emojis, their senses have dulled. And many are decorating their messages with too many exclamation points. If you have more than one or two in a message, recipients will suspect that you don't know how to use the English language to express your sentiments. Limit the number and use your computer's thesaurus feature instead. People with rich vocabularies are considered more creative, educated, and intelligent. And to think, all you need to do is click on a word. Dozens of choices pop up to enhance your messages without emojis or exclamation points. Chapter 19. Can you be too nice at work? Some employees go overboard with wanting to be liked, so they needlessly suffer in silence and don't speak up when they should. For example, I've heard hundreds of complaints like these about office conditions, and many of them are warranted. There's never any toilet paper in the John. It's as cold as a crypt in here. The noise from the air conditioning's driving me crazy. The chairs are as hard as rocks. The first step is to ask yourself, is this something I can put up with? Can I just chew it up, spit it out, and get on with my day? If so, give that a shot first, because nobody respects a whiner. But if you don't speak up about an intolerable condition at work, you might find yourself in the same situation as Polly the parrot. Oh, you haven't heard about Polly the parrot, who spoke 14 languages? Let me tell you about this rare bird. A loving husband was searching for an anniversary gift for his dear wife of 20 years. As he ambled by a pet store, a parrot squawked out to him. "Hello there. I speak 14 languages." "What?" the astonished man said, coming to a screeching halt and spinning around. "Oui," the parrot said in French. Are you serious?" the man asked. "Certo," the parrot replied in Italian. "No," the man exclaimed. "Si," the parrot countered in Spanish. The man raced into the pet store and asked the owner how much the rare bird cost. $5,000, sir."
$5,000?
The man shrieked. "Well, yes, sir," the owner replied, "because she's the only parrot in the world who speaks 14 languages." "Well," the man thought to himself, "my wife is a language buff, and this is our 20th anniversary." "All right," he said with a sigh, writing out a big fat check. He packed Polly, Polylingual was her full name, under his arm and headed home with the prize parrot. He decided to mount Polly's new perch right over the kitchen sink, where his wife would be sure to see the talented rare bird when she returned from shopping. As he was placing Polly up on her new perch, he suddenly slapped his head, realizing he had forgotten the bird seed. He raced back to the store. When he got home, his wife had already returned from her shopping, and she greeted him at the door. She threw her arms around him and exclaimed, "I didn't think you'd even remember our anniversary, let alone surprise me with such a wonderful gift." The man beamed. She continued, "Darling, you remembered how much I love pheasant."
"Pheasant?" he gasped.
"Yes," she replied. "I've got him plucked, I've got him slit, I've got him stuffed. He's already in the oven, and he'll be ready to eat in about half an hour."
"You've got him what? You've got him where? That was no pheasant," he howled. "That was a parrot. And what's more, that parrot cost $5,000 because it spoke 14 languages."
"Oh, really?" replied his wife. "Well, then, why didn't he speak up?" You've probably guessed the message in this fable. If you don't speak up, well, I won't say your goose will be cooked like poor Polly's, but if you don't tell a relevant person about the problem, the first thought will be, "Schnook, well, why didn't you say something?" Without mincing words, I call this technique little trick number 22. Put up, shut up, or speak up. The next time you're tempted to complain, stop and think about it. Is there anything you could possibly do to alleviate the situation? If so, do it now. And if your hands are tied, mention the problem to your boss, not as a complaint, but as an FYI. Be sure to have some suggested resolutions to present at the same time. Chapter 20. Should you have close friends at work? Wow, that's the million-dollar question. For happiness and fulfillment in life, we all need friends. Friends on the job make the workday much more pleasant. In fact, friends, the flesh and blood ones you've actually met and often see, not the social media ones, are one of the greatest joys in life. But what's your definition of a real friend? Most people feel it's someone you can share your innermost thoughts and dreams with. It's someone who is there for you no matter what. It's someone who has your best interests at heart. Now think of the people you work with. Do you think it's safe to share your innermost thoughts and dreams with them?
Do you think many of them would be there for you no matter what? If push came to shove, do you really think they'd have your best interest at heart or their own? Sometimes it's difficult to know whom you can trust. In my seminars, I've heard scads of stories about coworkers who pretend to be chums but would throw you under the bus in a heartbeat. One of my students, Pasha, told me that at her first job, she became fast friends with a woman who'd helped with some of her work. "When we became very close," she said, "I started sharing some of my personal problems. I even confided that I'd once had a drinking problem and told her Alcoholics Anonymous meetings were a godsend because they'd helped me quit." Pasha continued, "The following week, 5 or 6 of us were talking on our lunch hour, and one of the guys in the group asked me, 'Hey, have you been keeping up with your AA meetings?' I wanted to die because my supervisor was there and knew nothing about them. My so-called friend probably told everybody." Times are rapidly changing, and my advice 10 years ago would have been, try to keep your social and work life separate. But in today's progressive companies, that's inconceivable, and often by design. To draw the best talent from millennials, Gen Xers, and Gen Yers, smart organizations, in addition to having a fantastic digital infrastructure, are creating workspaces that encourage collaboration and the ability to balance work and leisurely activities. Forward-thinking companies recognize that friendships are a basic need. Laugh, play, collaborate, enjoy your colleagues, but heed the warning label on giving coworkers too much information about your personal life. If your ranks differ, close office friendships have a little skull and crossbones label. Several months ago, one of my students, Serena, who supervised an all-female marketing department at a cosmetics firm, asked if she could talk to me for a few minutes after class. She said she had a question. "Of course, Serena, ask away. I hope I have an answer." "Well, Leal, headquarters gave me the go-ahead to promote one of my direct reports to team leader. I'd like to choose Lynn, who stands head and shoulders above the rest. She's super creative, always gets her reports in on time, and has excellent follow-through. But I can't decide whether to give the promotion." "Why not?" I asked. "Well," she continued, "during our breaks, I talk with Lynn a lot, and we often sit together in the company lunchroom. We became friends out of the office, too." Whoops, I thought. Here comes a familiar problem. "Well, now Lynn and I have lunch together several times a month at Applebee's. Last week, I felt some women across the restaurant staring at us. When I looked over, I saw that 3 of them reported to me. As soon as I looked up, they made nosedives back into their sandwiches, pretending they hadn't seen us. Now I hesitate to promote Lynn because everyone would think I was playing favorites." I told Serena I understood, but not knowing all the subtleties and nuances of her other relationships at work, I hesitated to advise her. However, I want to share her story with you so you can think twice if you're ever in a situation where it might look like friendship with a coworker is clouding your judgment. We all need friends, and the workplace is changing drastically as you're reading this. Experts speak of the social workforce in which the people you work with will become, in a sense, family. This is lovely, but getting too close to someone on the job is dangerous, especially if your positions differ. While enjoying your office relationships, tread carefully to avoid cliques, gossip, and jealousy. And don't give your workplace pal TMI, too much information, about yourself, meaning anything you wouldn't be comfortable with the whole company knowing. Little trick number 23. Take care what you share at work. As corporate communication becomes more virtual, flesh and blood relationships become all the more precious. But be careful when it comes to confidentiality. Don't share secrets or talk about what you feel are your weaknesses. I've heard hundreds of sad stories about the problems this has caused. Backstabbing and slander are just the tip of the iceberg. Bonding is beautiful, but beware. To express that you are a truly caring person at work, use all the techniques we've discussed. Treat your colleagues' egos like eggshells Make your smile mean something. State their sentiments for connection. Amplify their earned praise. Put professional warmth in your emails. Turn fully toward the person you're talking with. And, of course, use your most powerful communication tool, your eyes. Connect with coworkers in these ways, but don't make the mistake of getting too close and letting your guard down. It's not called the corporate jungle for nothing. Chapter 21, A Primal Need. Before I tell you my view on this volatile subject, I want to share my deeply felt sentiment about physical human touch. It could be a brief pat on the back, a friendly hair ruffling, a guy-type shoulder punch, girls' amicable arm linking, an exuberant high five, or even an innocent touch of one woman's hand on another female employee's. Touch is a powerful and poignant force in our lives. Your need for it began when you were enveloped in the close quarters of your mother's womb for 9 months, and it didn't stop at birth. The moment you made your screaming, flailing entrance into the world, you continually needed touch for healthy development. Something as simple as a loving touch has been proved to make the difference between life and death for children in an orphanage, and its potency remains throughout life until the very end. Nursing homes report the phenomenal effect of human touch on residents' health, happiness, and longevity. I care intensely about this, so before I put my case to rest, let me share a bit more. Studies show that the brief, compassionate touch of a doctor makes patients think the physician stayed twice as long. And students receiving a supportive pat on the back or touch on the arm were far more likely to volunteer for projects. Dentists whose hands brushed their patients' faces while working on them got more referrals. In yet another study, nurses had to warn women entering a brain scanner that they would receive a shock. The MRI showed that the women's fear circuits relaxed when the nurses lightly touched them. I have probably gone on too long here, but the point is paramount. Touch is powerful. Touch is crucial. Touch is a primal need. But in the workplace, touch is a definite no. It's clear and simple. No touching at work. In the 1990s, during the war on drugs, the big advertising slogan was "Just Say No." These words were a powerful deterrent, and now, especially since the long overdue war on sexual harassment, we must resist any form of physical contact at work, no matter how innocent. Women, we must curb our natural instinct to put our arms around a dear friend at work to comfort her. Men, you should even swear off buddy-style backpats and arm punches. And when it comes to any kind of touch with the opposite sex, no matter how innocent, just say no. Little trick number 24. Do not touch. Touch with your eyes, touch with your smile, and touch with your warm words. But don't touch with your bodies. Imagine everyone you work with is wearing a do not touch label. Other than a friendly handshake on the job, save the warm friendship signals for friends who don't work at your company. Hands off at work. Period. Now let's move on to the next crucial element for career success, communicating your ideas clearly and understanding what your coworkers are saying. Part 3. Clarity. Chapter 22. How to see what they're saying. So what is clear communicating at work? Sounds simple enough. It's telling coworkers or your boss something and they understand. Then they tell you something and you understand. No problem, right? Whoa. Then why are there so many communication problems at work? Because communication is a two-way street and you are responsible for both sides. You as the speaker and you as the listener. You'll find hundreds of books on better communication, but not one on listening comes to mind. I mean, would you have shelled out your hard-earned cash if this one was titled, How to Listen to Anyone at Work? Not likely, because listening doesn't sound like much fun. Don't worry, though. I won't take much of your time on this boring subject, other than to restate how critical, consequential, conclusive, crucial, major, meaningful, and momentous it is, and central to your success at work. So let's get listening out of the way before we get to the more fun part, talking. On average, the human mind races 4 to 6 times faster than any speaker's words. So unless you're hearing something that impacts your life in an important way, your mind wanders. Plus, to respond appropriately or act on what someone has said, you must not only listen, but actually remember it. Therein lies the problem. According to the widely accepted cone of experience researched by Edgar Dale, we unfortunately only remember 20% of what we hear. But here's the good news and the basis of this little trick. Human beings remember more than half of what they both hear and see. That's why it's easier to recall details in a movie you've seen rather than a story you've heard. In a film, images, movements, and colors back up the sounds. So the trick is to turn the speaker's words into something you see, too. Make it an audio-visual experience by listening with your eyes, too. While your boss, colleague, customer, or report is talking to you, imagine 2 miniature screens floating in front of your eyes, sort of like wearing those clunky augmented reality glasses. While listening, create pictures or visualize what the speaker is saying. Bring her words to life in your mind's eye like a movie. Now you have no time to be bored, because you're not slowing your thought processes down, you're speeding them up. You are flushing out her flat words into clear 3D pictures for yourself, which makes listening much more exciting and memorable. Little trick number 25. Be an audio-visual listener. Don't just listen with your ears, listen with your eyes as well. Turn them into imaginary cameras to create a theatrical production of what you are both hearing and seeing. Not only do you get the picture more clearly, you also remember it longer. And it's fun, because your imagination is working overtime. Chapter 23. Make their words your words. It's human instinct. Whenever colleagues are talking, we tend to interject our own thoughts and form opinions every step of the way. You can't help it. You're smart, and since your mind works much faster than they can speak, naturally, you make judgments, but this is dangerous because you can come to incorrect conclusions before the speaker even finishes. Sure, I could tell you, reserve your judgments for later, but you know that's impossible. Unfortunately, forming premature opinions is dropping an enormous roadblock in the two-way street called clear communicating. Here's a technique to prevent you from that common communication killer and, at the same time, clarify your understanding of what's being said. For this little trick, you put on a different hat. Now you're no longer a filmmaker. You are a simultaneous translator. Translating from another language is a tough challenge, but it's a snap when it's English to English. Translators at the United Nations interpreting Spanish to Serbian, or Slovenian to Swahili, or Hungarian to Hindi don't have time to form opinions on what they're hearing. They simply repeat the speaker's words in a different language. So try this. As you're listening to someone talk, repeat silently what the speaker is saying, but put it in simpler terms, yours. Translate, sentence by sentence, what you're hearing into your own words. Suppose you have a self-important manufacturing client who is expounding in his own pompous business jargon. The name of the game for us is maximization. In your mind, translate that into your words. He wants to balance price and output for more profit. He continues, differentiation is of paramount importance. You silently say, he wants to show off the benefits of what he makes compared with the benefits of competing products. He then states, that's where electronic customer profiling helps. You again, my client wants to collect extensive information on his existing customers. We must integrate client-driven data into our strategy. To keep your mind from wandering, silently say, our plans must take into account what the customer wants.
Your sentences are a lot clearer and a heck of a lot easier for you to remember because you said them. You are simply repeating what the client was saying, but putting it into your own words.